Hi, thank you for listening to Special Interest. This is Eric J. This week, Justin Trudeau told Radio Canada that he thinks about quitting as Prime Minister constantly, but is still planning to continue as leader into the next election. At least two Liberal MPs now say they support an arms embargo against Israel because of its violations of international law, while the government more broadly pursues a more spineless take on the issue. A really lively debate between Piers Morgan and Mehdi Hassan on the issue of Gaza. I'll be getting into clips and all of that. Really great. And an op-ed writer makes the case that if Justin Trudeau were to step down right now, which is not an impossibility, it could destroy the Liberal Party if they don't first reckon with the issue of Gaza. And some very interesting reporting about the way the Liberal Party is internally pretty much freaking out about the issue, and some very crazy ideas about who could be the establishment anti-war candidate in a theoretical Liberal leadership race, and it's really not who anyone would guess. So Justin Trudeau was recently interviewed on EC Premier, which is basically like the French language equivalent of CBC Radio, where while he did insist he is still going to contest the next election as, you know, Prime Minister and Liberal leader, he did very interestingly acknowledge that he's constantly is thinking about quitting, leaving as Prime Minister. So I'm quoting from the article now, and this was him responding to a listener's question about his political future. He exclaimed, "But I'm thinking of leaving every day. It's a crazy job that I'm doing, sacrifices on a personal level. If I didn't doubt what I do almost every day, I wouldn't be human," the Prime Minister immediately admitted with emotion. But despite all the constraints and the wear and tear of power weighing down his boat, and this is a direct like auto translation from French, so some of it might not be as precise as it could be. There is no question of Justin Trudeau laying down his arms now. Democracies are so under attack around the world with extreme populism, with international attacks. To be there for this fight, that's why I entered politics. Not to be popular, not for personal reasons, but because I want to serve and I know that I have something to offer," insisted Justin Trudeau. So this is obviously a very topical question right now. Like, are you actually gonna stay as leader, lead the party into the next election against Pierre Poilievre? Because you have Pierre Poilievre and you have these, you know, poll after poll after poll that shows the Liberals just astoundingly underwater with the Conservatives, at least in the, I haven't checked like very recent polls, but at least definitely like a month or two ago, the polling was, you know, looking like a Conservative majority. Now, that's not to say they would have the support of a majority of Canadians. The majority of Canadians, by any measure you look at, are not conservative supporters. Conservatives haven't had the support of a majority of Canadians since, you know, Brian Mulroney back in the 80s. Was it 80s or 90s? But back in, you know, no, because he ended in 93. Yeah, 80s. And even that Conservative Party was the Progressive Conservative Party was very different from the modern Conservative Party, which is very much the successor of the far right, reformers. And today, like, very American Republican far right style, like, you know, or even Kim Campbell was recently calling out Pierre Poilievre, calling him a liar and a hate monger. And I'm sure if Brian Mulroney was still alive, he would not be voting for the Pierre Poilievre Conservatives in the next election. You do have Pierre Poilievre, you know, embracing this very, as I said, embracing this very American far-right Republican style faux populist politics. You know, him recently making this really strong tirade against trans people, refusing to even like acknowledge the existence of trans women, you know, referring to them as biological males and talking about, oh yeah, we really need to make sure, you know, the top priority is we really got to make sure we, you know, they're not allowed to use their pronouns and that they're, you know, banned from sports and, you know, all these things. He's always been like kind of anti-journalist, but he's probably really been, he's been doing it particularly particularly forcefully lately. Like, he did this big rally, and he's been doing all these, it's weird, he's been doing all these, like, campaign rallies when we're not in an election period, and we're not even officially in an election year, right? There's always, you know, a little bit of an unstable partnership with the NDP sometimes, especially when they were, you know, stalling on pharmacare. So, you know, it's a possibility you could get an early election, and that's why they're also, like, you know, everyone's nominating candidates a little early. I don't know if this is early. I don't follow that stuff that closely usually. There's always a possibility there could be an election. But anyway, he did this big rally, this, like, Axe the Tax rally, I think it was. And he invited the media into it, right? He could have done it as, like, a private event. There are lots of, like, party events that aren't for the media, like, especially donor stuff, where it's like, okay, the media's not coming in to cover that. We're just going to be talking, like, with our supporters or with our donors or whatever. But he invited the media into it. They recorded the speech. They, you know, record and take pictures of him with his supporters. But then once the speech is over, he says, okay, that's enough. You can go now. We're not going to be taking any questions. It's like, no, you can't, like, you can't just bring them in. And because there were, you know, videos of his speech put out. There were articles, you know, stenographing all of his points, but they weren't allowed to question him and question any of those points. So you don't get to just have the media be your stenographers and skip the question part of it. That's not how it works in a democracy. And I did see someone on Twitter making the point that, okay, you should, they should, at a certain point, the media should just, like, almost refuse to write up, the pieces about these rallies if you're not going to allow the media to actively participate. Like, why, like, are you just gonna let him turn you into his stenographers? But anyway, so you obviously have these horrible polls for the liberals and horrible approval ratings and likabilities for Justin Trudeau specifically. I think it is at a point, like, for me, it's like, and I'm not a fan of the liberals by any measure. I definitely prefer them to, especially a Pierre Poilievre, like, more right-wing, far-right government. And I, you know, I began my political consciousness under the Harper government. Like, I remember some of the awful things that were happening, and so much of the, you know, scapegoating of Muslims and you know, inaction and bad action on indigenous issues and horrible action on environmental issues, everything, right? And Pierre Poilievre, I think, would be even worse than Stephen Harper. But, like, I can't see a scenario where the Liberal Party under Justin Trudeau can win the next election. Like, I don't think, like Trudeau, what I have heard from people who, I guess, talk to, like, you know, to, like, liberal MPs who aren't that big fans of his necessarily, what they say is basically, like, he really, really hates Pierre Poilievre, and he thinks it's his destiny to beat him. Like, he thinks he's the only one in the party that'll be able to beat him and stop him from stop the conservatives from coming back into government. And to me, that just feels like a really big ego thing. Like, it reminds me of the stuff with, like, Joe Biden, where, you know, he's staying, and even though he was originally saying he was going to be a, you know, transitional, like, one-term president, but he's staying in, one, because of his big ego, and because he thinks he's the only one that can beat Trump, where I think now you can really see, okay, the opposite was true, right? He is a uniquely terrible candidate to go against Trump. And if you had, like, a kind of generic Democrat, they would definitely be doing way, way better. I mean, there's definitely someone who would do worse, but so many that would be doing so much better than Joe Biden. And I think it's a similar thing with Trudeau. I think he thinks he's the only one that can do it. I think at this point, he's so much more of a liability than he is an asset. Like, I think if you had almost like a random liberal, an outsider would be great, but even like a random like cabinet minister, like take like, you know, Sean Fraser, the housing minister who, you know, did, you know, at least has made some good like rhetorical stuff. I feel like someone like that would probably be like a better, like would arguably be better against up here. Like our, like the ideal would be someone who is not Trudeau, doesn't have connections, doesn't have too many direct connections to Trudeau or even necessarily the government, can appear as something of like an outsider, that okay, it's not just going to be the exact same government, it's going to be like sort of a new thing, it can feel like a reset, and is also, you know, charismatic and can hold his own against Pierre Poilievre. That specific combination might be a bit of a fantasy, but that would probably be like your ideal. I mean, my ideal would be someone replaces Jagmeet Singh as NDP leader, like Alessandro Boulayeris replaces Jagmeet Singh as NDP leader, and the Liberal Party completely collapses, support goes to the NDP, and we get our first NDP prime minister. That is even more of a fantasy, but I don't know how many good options we have here. But yeah, so that's obviously the context that Trudeau is making these comments in. So he continues, "Are we a country that will," this is Trudeau speaking, "are we a country that will choose to move backwards in the fight against climate change, to move backwards in the rights of women and again, French, LGBT communities? Are we going to be a country that invests less in green growth because that's all that the conservatives are proposing?" Very true. And he also says that he's going to maintain the carbon tax. "It's a measure that not only fights climate change and encourages innovation and improvements in our emissions, but also puts money in the pockets of 8 out of 10 families across the country," Trudeau argued. "In an affordability crisis where people are having trouble paying for their groceries, what the conservatives are proposing is to withdraw these checks, which give citizens more." This is, I think a point that, I mean, I don't know if he's necessarily even making this point. I mean, yeah, he kind of is, but that I don't see liberals, New Democrats making nearly enough that, like, and this is going to feel like a little bit of a tangent, but I was reading this really great book about the history of the Great Depression in Canada by Pierre Burton, which is really, really great and covers a really wide array of everything around the crisis and everything leading up to it. And it talked about the political side of it, where, you know, Mackenzie King was basically a total idiot, who was the Liberal prime minister, and he was like, I think still like the longest serving prime minister ever, I think. Though it's sort of breaking up around, kind of breaking up. He's out of office and then he's back in, but, you know, combined, it's the longest prime ministership. But so he was basically an idiot around the Great Depression, and he completely underestimated it the entire time. He just thought he thought it was going to blow over. He thought people were, you know, exaggerating over it. And the conservatives ran this very great, clever campaign where they were using all this populist rhetoric, and they're talking about how, you know, we're going to fight for you, we're going to fight for the working man, we're going to fight for the unemployed man, we're going to, you know, bring prosperity back to Canada, and, you know, bring you relief and everything. But if you actually looked at the actual policies they were proposing, it didn't jive with the, with the rhetoric at all, right? It was stuff like, you know, we're gonna bring back the tariff, which was literally just the, at that point, had been the go-to conservative like economic proposal, you know, for what would have been a probably, you know, for decades and decades. Like, that's not a new thing. That's not gonna, how is that gonna solve the problem of all of these people being out of work? And that made me think so much about the current Conservative Party, where they have great, you know, Paul Yeff, he has great rhetoric. He's great at identifying problems. I think even at identifying, you know, hey, this is a problem that, you know, Trudeau isn't doing anything about, or Trudeau is making worse. But all of his proposed solutions, like, wouldn't do anything, right? So, like, when he would, you know, make these big speeches about how awful inflation is, yes, that's very true. But, like, when you would, or about, you know, people's, like, unemployment and everything. But when you actually look at, okay, well, what policies would you want? Because we talk about him talking about inflation, how he thinks, like, Trudeau's inflationary policies caused it. What he's usually talking about is stuff like CERB, right? Where obviously, like, during COVID, people were struggling, losing their jobs, losing houses. And finally, you know, the government agreed to, you know, give them relief, right? Give them CERB payments so they could live. And the Conservatives, like, what they're saying now would be, well, we shouldn't have done that. We should have let people starve. We should have let people suffer. And there's so many things like that, right? Like, he's great at diagnosing the problem. All of his solutions would either not really make a difference or would make things worse. But I'm really not sure that that's actually going to make a difference here. So amidst all the backlash that the Canadian government is facing for its broadly pro-Israel position, while they appear to be committing genocide, ethnic cleansing, certainly mass slaughter and killing of civilians, you know, the recent multiple flower massacres killing hundreds of Palestinians while they're trying to get food. There are interestingly now two liberal MPs, federal liberal MPs, who are now breaking ranks and calling for an Israel arms embargo. So this is in an article by Jeremy Appel in the Maple, which is a really great site that's been doing a lot of great reporting, especially recently. So two liberal MPs in the Toronto area, this is Nathaniel Smith and one other, have broken ranks with the Trudeau government regarding Israel's assault on Gaza, endorsing an arms embargo on Israel until it complies with international law. So this is, like, at the same time as we had, this was in the show I did last week, we have the Foreign Affairs Ministry being sued by Palestinian Canadians and human rights lawyers who are trying to force them to stop their military exports to Israel because, based on Canadian and international law, we're not allowed, it's not legal to sell weapons to a country if there is a significant risk that those weapons will be used to violate international law. And so, because, like, even if you don't acknowledge that Israel is committing or attempting a genocide, by any measure, they're obviously constantly breaking international law. They barely even deny that at this point. So as of March 11th, Israel's attacks have killed more than 31,000 people in Gaza, including 12,300 children, according to Palestinian health officials. Another 8,000 are believed to be buried under the rubble. This was written March 12th. This will be a little bit, numbers are probably a bit bigger by now. Meanwhile, the Israeli military continues to impede deliveries of humanitarian aid entering the besieged enclave and has repeatedly fired on aid trucks. On March 5th, this is what I just mentioned about the Palestinian Canadians, Davenport MP Julie Zerowicz announced her support for suspending Canada's arms exports to Israel in a statement published on March 1st. The statement was an update of an earlier version that did not include such a call. In the updated statement, Zerowicz included that she acknowledged that she's had many constituents contact her office for an end to arms exports to Israel, sanctions on Israel, and severing diplomatic ties with the state. Zerowicz approvingly cited the Office of the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights' February 23rd statement calling for an immediate halt to all arms exports to Israel. I support their calls for an arms embargo, Zerowicz said. And the Maple reached out to 23 other liberal to the 23 liberal MPs who signed an October 17th petition calling for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza 2 months before Prime Minister Justin Trudeau did, asking whether they share Zerowicz's position on arms exports to Israel. Zerowicz was not a signatory to that October petition. The only response came from Beaches East York MP Nathaniel Erskine-Smith, who provided a link to a February 17th post on his Substack newsletter calling for Global Affairs Canada to review whether or not Canadian military exports to Israel comply with the International Arms Trade Treaty, to which Canada is a signatory, and the Domestic Export and Import Permits Act, EIPA. As Global Affairs reviews and reconsiders the position, we should pause any further exports for the foreseeable future, Erskine Smith added in an email to the Maple. And very, you know, it's a very, you know, not surprising that both of these MPs, you know, the only two MPs that have so far made this position, that both of them are in, you know, like, I think the both downtown Toronto, Davenport, definitely. And I'm pretty sure Nathaniel Erskine Smith is from downtown Toronto. Downtown or Midtown, because, you know, obviously there you have to compete a lot more with, like, you know, you're really competing with the NDP, and they obviously have a much stronger position on that. Yes, and so there were three other liberals, Shafkat Ali, Joël Lightbound, and Canada-Palestine Parliamentary Friendship Group Chair. I did not know there was a Canada-Palestine Parliamentary Friendship Group. Salma Zahid have entertained the possibility of supporting an arms embargo in the wake of the International Court of Justice's ruling that Israel is plausibly committing genocide in Gaza, as has Bloc Québécois leader Yves-François Blanchet. None of these MPs, however, have publicly endorsed an arms embargo. So there's two that are, yes, we support arms. I believe the NDP support an arms embargo. They've generally been pretty decent on Palestine, at least since... In this war, at least. So that's two that support so two that support an embargo, and that's three or four, though the fourth would represent, you know, whole party, that are, let's call them a maybe. Okay, yeah. So the federal NDP has explicitly called for an end to arms sales to Israel since May 2021, when Israel launched a previous assault on Gaza. That position is also shared, of course, by the Green Party. And this also is coming at the same time as there's a report from CBC Radio Canada that Ottawa is reportedly has been basically stalling. On requests from Israel for the for permission to import certain military vehicles, armored vehicles, and the government's also, so this is from that article, government has also withheld clearance of exports for non-lethal equipment to Israel, source says. The federal government is deliberately slow-walking a request from Israel for permission to import Canadian-made armored patrol vehicles, two sources tell Radio Canada. Shortly after the October 7th, which had left 1,200 people dead and 250 others taken hostage, the Israeli government sent a request to the Office of Foreign Affairs Minister Melanie Joly for clearance to import about 30 armored patrol vehicles from Ontario manufacturer Rochelle. Ottawa must grant the necessary export licenses before the transaction can be completed, but Israel's request has remained in limbo ever since, as the federal government strives to strike a delicate domestic balance on its position on the Israel-Hamas conflict. As reported by the Toronto Star, the federal government has also withheld approval for exports to Israel of non-lethal military goods and technology, such as night vision goggles, because of concerns the equipment could be used in certain human rights violations. A source told CBC News that those in government reviewing such applications have raised concerns about the possibility of the equipment being misused. The source said the reviewers are struggling to draw firm conclusions due to the constantly changing situation in Gaza. As a result, no permits to export non-lethal military goods and technology to Israel have been cleared in the past 2 months, the source said. Yeah, so this to me is like another example of the liberals very clearly trying to, you know, have it both ways and play both sides on Israel-Palestine. I would say they're doing a much better job at it than, say, someone like Joe Biden is in the U.S. where, you know, he is underwater because of this, and he's like trying now to kind of have it both ways. Like either way, I think this idea of either way, I think it's a political disaster, right? Even if Trudeau's doing it like slightly better than like, you know, someone like Biden, not taking a side, and trying to and the fact that this story is coming out, this is obviously like to me, this is obviously like a targeted leak by the government, by the liberals, to send the message that, hey, we're trying, right? We're not, you know, we're not that heartless. We are, yes, we know there's these calls for an embargo. We're stalling. We're not, you know, we're not signing it right away, right? To send the message that they care a little bit about Palestinians being killed. But like, no, they should be doing a full embargo. Like they're trying to do this in a way where they cannot give, and maybe this is for their own conscience as well, right? To not give those weapons, but also to not say we are officially not going to give those weapons, and because we are imposing an embargo, because Israel is engaged in, you know, whether you want to call it a genocide or human rights violations or, you know, indiscriminate bombings, international law violation, whatever justification you want to give. Like, it's just it. I just can't see it as anything but, you know, just being gutless. Gutless and spineless. Like, it's. I hope this is like a stepping stone. I hope this is like they are starting to see the light, and that they will stop supporting Israel in this way and stop like it like seeing your country. Like, you always think, you know, how would we today, how would we in modern day, like, respond to a genocide happening before our eyes? And it's just like seeing, you know, Canadian money and weapons. Going towards Israel, and not even anything as small as, you know, Canada saying, hey, this genocide happening is wrong. Like, I don't, I don't, I don't have, I guess I don't have, guess I don't really have much to say. It's just, I hope this will lead to, I hope as they get more backlash, I hope they will just stop it altogether, impose a full embargo. Like they did move, they have moved. Like, look at where they were like 3 months ago, very different position. They are, you know, I believe, yeah, it was in the article, right, that the Canada is now, has now been, Trudeau is now calling for a ceasefire. I might, because that I think was news to me. I might have to look into that because. Is it like the Biden thing where he's supposed like a temporary ceasefire, or does he support a real ceasefire, permanent, leading to negotiations and lasting peace? It's depressing, man, right? Like I follow the news all the time because I think it's, you know, very important to keep on top of it, but some of it is just it after a while, like, yeah, it does just start to get to you. So Mehdi Hasan is a British American progressive political commentator who had previously been a host on Al Jazeera and most recently on MSNBC. You know, really well known for his, like, you know, really great debates and combative interview style, long, you know, monologues and explainers. And his his show was at the start of the year was canceled by MSNBC. Most people believe because of his coverage of the Israel-Palestine conflict, which was, you know, really great and like surprisingly good, and you know, unusual for most of American cable news, was very strongly from a pro-Palestinian perspective, and he had these really great interviews with like Israeli spokespeople where he just completely, you know, crushed them and demolished all their you know, the propaganda they were trying to spew about what was happening in the war. And so, yeah, most people think, okay, he was, because you see a lot of cracking down against pro-Palestinian commentary, activism in, you know, mainstream American, Canadian, etc. media and society at large. So, you know, I would definitely say that's a very fair guess. He's, you know, trying to say, you know, hey, you'll have to ask them, right? I'm not going to comment on that. But so he, and following that, a lot of people were wondering, you know, what's he going to do next? And he's very recently just announced that he's going to be creating his own new media company called Zateo, which is not just going to be, you know, the place for him to continue doing his commentary and his work and his interviews, but also, you know, creating a whole network and bringing in a bunch of other personalities, I guess progressive personalities. So building out a whole new network. And he was recently interviewed by Piers Morgan, which, like, the two of them, like, if you do actually look at it, they actually surprisingly, like, have a lot in common in a lot of ways, right? Obviously, they are both, you know, say, like, outspoken, controversial, you know, British personalities that are, you know, that moved to America to do a big, you know, U.S. cable news show. So, like, where Piers Morgan took over for Larry King on CNN. And both eventually were basically, you know, from people's perspectives, were kicked out because of their, you know, controversial views on a particular issue. With Mehdi, that was Israel-Palestine. With Piers, that was oddly his position on America's gun culture, which is very anti and a bit of a touchy issue for a lot of people, obviously. And they've both, well, I don't think Mehdi, or I don't think Piers has gone like independent exactly. He's got like this show, like his show is called Piers Morgan Uncensored. I think it's like part of some wider, I think it's like that like British Fox News thing, like the GBN, I think it's like that. But so they had a very interesting interview where they, you know, talked about a number of topics, but I think, you know, for me, most interestingly was them talking about Israel-Palestine.
Let me just take you back to October the 7th. I want you to imagine, and it's a bit of a leap, I admit, but I want you to imagine that you are the Prime Minister of Israel when that atrocity happens in Israel. What do you do?
That's a great question. So short answer is I resign because I'm responsible for that attack. I'm the one who botched security at the border. I'm the one who propped up Hamas with money from Qatar over the years and allowed them to be propped up as a way to divide the Palestinian people. I'm the one who's had millions of my own people on the streets for months protesting against my authoritarian reforms to the judiciary. So I have some shame. I have some self-respect. I have some honesty. And I say, I quit. Let someone else do this because I've failed for 20 years.
A really great first point from Eddie. So, like, obviously, we can go around in circles talking about, like, you know, who started what, and who's responsible for this war. Like, obviously, you'll have an Israel supporter point endlessly to the unprovoked attacks on October 7th as, you know, the root of all of it. And okay, well, history started 3 months ago. A Palestinian could point to, for example, the 2022 Israeli attacks, provocations against the Al-Aqsa Mosque. It was definitely during which is one of the most sacred sites in Islam, certainly one of the most sacred sites in Palestine. It was during, I can't remember if it was like during last Ramadan or during like Eid Mubarak, or I mean not last, or 2022, I'm pretty sure it was 2022. I think it was Eid Mubarak. So it's like, you know, so it's like attacking one of the biggest churches in Christianity on Christmas Eve, right? And you know, obviously any number of attacks back and forth, going back to the you know, ethnic cleansing of Palestine in the Nakba in 1948. But it is definitely like a very fundamental point that so much of October 7th is ultimately the fault of Benjamin Netanyahu, right? Where he, you know, years ago was talking about the need to send this funding through Qatar to Hamas, to fund and prop up Hamas, to divide the Palestinians between Hamas in Gaza and the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank, so that a two-state solution, a Palestinian state, would become virtually impossible. And that you would be, and with Hamas being more of a face of at least part of the Palestinian people, you're able to further destroy the idea of a two-state solution, because you can say, oh, hey, the only part, I don't have any partners in peace, right? The only, you know, the Palestinians are Hamas, and Hamas just wants to kill all the Jews. You know, and then right before October 7th, when he had intelligence from, I think it was from Egypt, saying, you know, hey, we think we got some intelligence, we think something's happening with Hamas. Hamas is like planning some big attack, and completely ignored it, and instead diverted security that could have been at the border with Gaza, but they diverted it to the West Bank so they could support the illegal Israeli settlers, who are dispossessing the Palestinians there and attacking the Palestinians there, right? Incredible violence from the settlers towards the Palestinians in the West Bank. And you really don't, we really have to keep that in mind of how much this is really Netanyahu's fault.
And I'll be honest, I've said this a lot on my Uncensored show, that I felt a real moral quandary. You know, I can go back over tweets I've done back in 2014, where I said that Israel's response to provocation by Palestinians at the time was bordering on terrorism. You know, I have somebody who, when I was editor of the Daily Mirror, opposed the Iraq war before, during and after very vociferously. And I think that aged pretty well, that campaign. I'm somebody that when the Qatar World Cup happened, you know, I sprang to defense of Qatar's right to host the World Cup and exposed a lot of Western hypocrisy. And yet when it comes to this particular conflict, I feel genuinely conflicted, for want of a better phrase. And the point of my conflict is that the reason I asked you that question about if you were the Prime Minister of Israel, it's very, very difficult to know how any Prime Minister of Israel could have responded in a particularly different manner to the way that Netanyahu did. Putting aside all the reasons that you say he should have resigned, and by the way, I broadly agree with them.
So,
in terms of the Israel people, the Prime Minister at the time, the response to what happened that day was going to always have to be enormous, wasn't it?
So you're right in terms of the emotional response. It was going to be enormous. And I would take us back to 9/11, Piers. You mentioned Iraq. After 9/11, there was an emotional response in the US that something had to be done, right? There's the famous yes minister dialogue. Something has to be done. This is something. Let's do it. And we invaded Afghanistan, which didn't solve the problem of terrorism, made it worse, punished innocent people who had nothing to do with 9/11. And you'll remember at the time, Piers, both parties in the United States supported going into Afghanistan. Only one member of Congress, not Bernie Sanders, Barbara Lee of California, voted to oppose that war. Two decades on, many people would say she was vindicated, even though she was an isolated voice and she was going against a tidal wave of opinion from liberals and conservatives said, we have to do something. And I get that. After an atrocity happens, people want to do something. But the best leaders, the most strategic leaders, the most moral leaders are the ones who can take a pause, take a breath and say, are we going to make the situation better or worse? Are we striking out strategically or just for the sake of vengeance and revenge? And you talk about Israeli prime ministers having to do this. Look, they didn't have to do it on this level. I think a lot of Israelis, despite supporting Netanyahu, would argue it didn't have to be done like this. There are different ways to retaliate against Hamas. The irony is no Israeli government has done it like this before. This is the greatest death toll for Palestinians of any war in Israel's post-1948 history. So the fact that he did it like this was unique. I mean, look, the statistics speak for themselves. Piers, you know them. You've said them on this show.
Yeah.
The level of killing, the number of kids killed. You have one former UN official saying this is the highest kill rate in the world since Rwanda, right, of any conflict since Rwanda. Do not tell me that the only response to a brutal attack on civilians in Israel on October the 7th was to produce a conflict that had a kill rate equivalent to Rwanda's.
So, spot-on points by Mehdi. And, you know, I've heard Piers make this argument a few times because I have actually started to occasionally watch his show because at least on this particular issue and on Israel Palestine in the context of this war, he's been fairly good at least being fair and bringing on a lot of pro-Palestinian voices, and you get a lot of great debates between pro-Palestinian voices and representatives of Israel or just very outlandish Zionist supporters. But so I've heard him make this point a number of times of, you know, yes, of course, what's been happening in this war, what Israel's been doing, the sheer volume of children, of civilians, the utter devastation of Gaza as a whole has been, you know, horrific and unconscionable. But what could Israel be doing other than this, right? What is the what's the alternative, right? Because of course, if you're attacked by this, horrible terrorist attack, and I would say, you know, regardless of circumstances, you know, leading up to it, that obviously, you know, things like the occupation, all these are obviously, root causes of it. But you know, the example I like to use is, you know, think of Canada. And imagine if there was some like far right terrorist militia coming out of Michigan, and even imagine an alternate version of history where Canada had 70 years ago invaded and colonized Michigan, and were continuing to occupy it. I would, you know, obviously say, well, we shouldn't be occupying it, and the occupation would be the, you know, is, I'm sure, the root cause of violence that we're getting from Michigan. It's not just that Michiganers really, it's not exclusively that Michiganers just hate Canadians. But still, like, of course, if there was some major terrorist attack into, what is Michigan border? Like Manitoba or something? You know, if there was some big terrorist attack, still, of course, okay, there would need to be, like, some response, even if our political, you know, your political point of view is, why the frick are we occupying Michigan? We should stop that, and we'll probably have less terrorism, but you would still, you would need some kind of response. But, of course you need some kind of response. That doesn't mean carpet bombing an indiscriminate killing, mass slaughter of civilians is the only possible solution. Like, you know, for instance, like Canada and the U.S., we have experience in Western countries, many Western countries, we have experience at fighting terrorist movements, guerrilla movements around the world. Like, you know, wars in Afghanistan, for example. We don't do it like this, and we know, and Mehdi, Mehdi makes this point, we know that that's not how you defeat terrorism. We know that's not an effective way of fighting terrorism. Like when we go into Afghanistan, which isn't a country of our people, And, you know, we did many, many bad things. And I think we did go too far in many instances in terms of the broader war on terror. But compared to what Israel's been doing in this war and in other wars, we look like angels. Like, that's one of the most, because I remember when years ago, the top thing we would talk about in terms of the horrors of especially American foreign policy is stuff like the drone war, where you're killing so many civilians. But like this stuff with Israel, it makes the Americans look like angels. Like, it's just so absurd. And we have, and Israel is one of the most technologically advanced militaries and best funded militaries in the world. And we have seen examples of, they can do targeted bombings. They can do very targeted killings. They're not doing it in Israel, or they're not generally doing it in Gaza. Like, I saw, this was during this conflict, this war, there was, I guess there was like a Hamas operative, or there was someone who was on a specific floor of this one building, and they and Israel managed to blow up only that one building. Only that one floor. The rest of the building was still intact. Everything around it was still intact. So there, they can say, okay, we're going to be very precise. But then in most cases, they're deciding to just blow up the whole building, blow up the whole block, blow up entire villages, hospitals, when they know there's so many civilians. So, like, really what you do see, the reason you're having all this is because they at best are negligent and don't care about the lives of Palestinian civilians, or at worst are actively trying to kill and displace Palestinian civilians and otherwise. I remember this was a while ago, like relatively early in the conflict, I think, but there was this great clip from a British radio show, I think it was LBC, where they had this caller, this right-wing caller who was there defending Israel, you know, and everything, and the host is like trying to get the guy to, like, you know, to get it, and he finally walks him through the scenario of, like, okay, what if Hamas, instead of being in Gaza, what if in an alternate universe, what if Hamas was hiding in Israel? Do you think Israel would be reacting the same way? And the guy said, well, no, of course not. And said, why? Why wouldn't they? Well, because, you know, they would be Israelis. And it's like, yeah, that's it, right? That's your smoking gun. That the reason they do it is because, the reason they're doing it like this is because they don't care, again, at best, they don't care if Palestinians live or die.
Here's what I would say, playing devil's advocate, and you might think, I'm literally playing devil's advocate, but I'm going to play it anyway, which is, all that is true. The death toll is horrific. The percentage of children being killed is horrific. But I would say, as a caveat to this, that if you think about it from the Israeli perspective, you've got 35,000 Hamas terrorists, and we'll come to whether you think they're terrorists or not in a moment, but you've got 35,000 Hamas soldiers, warriors, terrorists, whatever description you want to call them, depending on whose side you're on. And they are embedded amongst a civilian population where half that population is under 18. How else do you get rid of Hamas if you don't go about it in the blunt, brutal manner that Israel is doing? And if you do it the way they're doing it, how do you avoid the kind of casualty rate of people under 18, given that that's half the population?
So, three things very briefly. Number one, you do it by not deliberately targeting civilian targets and schools and hospitals and cemeteries and mosques and universities and churches. You don't have snipers shooting at hospitals or Christian women inside a church. That's how you avoid the casualties. Number two, I don't accept the premise of your question that this is the way to defeat Hamas. I think even if I'm an Israeli hawk, I criticize Netanyahu and say, this is not the way to defeat Hamas. This is actually absurd to think you can defeat Hamas in this way. We have countless episodes from history that show us this is not how you defeat a guerrilla movement, a resistance movement, a terror group, as you say, whatever words you want to use. In fact, you have Israeli generals saying this can't be done in this way. And number three, look, the reality is Hamas is a symptom of the problem. As long as you treat Hamas as the problem rather than as a symptom of the problem, you know. you're never going to get rid of Hamas. Or if you do, by some fantasy means, get rid of Hamas, you'll just get another version of Hamas, because now you've got tens of thousands of orphans, you've got people who've lost their kids, their spouses, their siblings. What, you think they're not going to fight back in the years to come? You know, you think they're not going to take
revenge?
Well,
that's how I feel.
It's absolute madness to believe.
I feel the same way.
Then we agree.
So, yeah, I think, broadly speaking, I do, because I think you can't kill the ideology. And, in fact, all you will do is entrench the ideology, I think. And that's what I don't think Israel have thought through to a logical end game, which is you're not going to get rid of the thinking that inspired Hamas, because a lot of people will have suffered such appalling grief with their close family in
but
the
again,
way you
Piers,
described, that they're going to want to get revenge.
I think you're being a little too generous to the Israelis here, and with the greatest respect, I think your questions reflect a little bit of a naivety about what Israel's doing here. You're starting from the premise that Israel is trying to defeat Hamas. I don't accept that premise. I don't believe that's what Israel is trying to do.
What do you think they're trying to do?
They wouldn't be doing it this way. I think they're trying to take back Gaza. I think they're trying to erase the resistance in Gaza. I think they're trying to get rid of the people from Gaza. I think this is their, you know, they've mowed the lawn, as they put it in previous wars. This time they're going in to erase the population. You know, there's a plausible genocide.
Okay, but let me ask you,
If you listen to Israeli officials, as you know, it's laid out in the South African petition, they are very genocidal in their approach to flattening and burning down Gaza. It's not about destroying Hamas. And if it was about destroying Hamas, why has Netanyahu and Smotrich and others talked about how Hamas is an asset to Israel? Why do they say that openly, Piers?
Well, he was clearly massively deluded, I think, Netanyahu, about having anything to do with Hamas. I think that Netanyahu's plan was quite straightforward, which was to separate Hamas from the Palestinian Authority and create a split in the Palestinians at an official level. And he thought that that was the best way of preserving security for Israel. He couldn't have been more wrong.
So I love that he is there actually challenging this narrative that that is still the, even among people in the mainstream and mainstream media that are much more critical of Israel, of Netanyahu, of all that, it's still very, you'll still find very few people that are actually questioning or challenging, you know, the narrative that, you know, Hamas is the number one goal, rather than ethnic cleansing and taking back, taking Gaza for Jewish Israelis, right? So, like, generally, the more critical mainstream narrative will be, you know, that, yes, this is horrible, these people are being killed and they shouldn't, but that's basically a result of an overzealous campaign against Hamas, right? That, well, the point is to get rid of the terrorists, to get rid of the Hamas militants, Hamas terrorists, but they're basically being like negligent and not caring enough about the civilians and about the Palestinian civilians, and they're incidentally killing all of these Palestinians because they don't care enough to save them. And like, I think if you do look at what prominent Israeli, whether it's, you know, Israeli politicians and ministers, prominent members of Israeli society, certainly the settlers and so many of the IDF soldiers, what they are saying is, like, no, we want to take back Gaza, right? They talk about, you know, taking the land, about repopulating it with Jewish settlers, like all the destruction and trying to move all the Palestinians out supposedly temporarily, which, you know, every time like Palestinians have been moved out temporarily because of concerns about violence, they've not been allowed a right to return, right? The point of, like, the reason they haven't let go of the West Bank and Gaza is because fundamentally they want those lands. Like, the reason they've been in this, like, legal limbo is because they want that territory, right? Like if you hear these, you know, hardcore like Israeli Zionists, they call Gaza, I believe they call it Judea. Like they believe the West Bank and Gaza are their divine right to possess, and so they want the land, but they've never wanted the people. They've always hated, you know, the pesky fact that there's a bunch of Palestinians there, because it means we can't just annex that land, because then the Arab population, the Arab Palestinian population in Israel goes from about 20% to I think it goes to like a majority, or maybe like a half, like a 50% thing, and they are very adamant about, no, we are, you know, we need a Jewish demographic majority in Israel. We need to, you know, maintain this, like, you know, this like ethnic purity. So that's why they've had, you know, them under occupation. And well, I mean, Gaza is slightly different, but like the West Bank, for instance, the reason they've had that under occupation for this whole time is because they want it, but they're not ready to let go of that territory, but they don't want the people, right? They've been doing like ethnic cleansing in slow motion. They did it in fast motion first. They've been doing ethnic cleansing in slow motion for 70 years. And that's the whole point of it. And this is, you know, because they want to finally finish the job of the Nakba that started in 1948. And, you know, you've seen, and there's so many examples and proof of this. And you've, you know, seen like really made headlines when there were these like Israeli real estate companies that were literally already like in the middle of the war, were advertising the land in Gaza as future Israeli houses, Israeli settlements. But nobody, like, other than people like Mehdi, you don't really see almost anyone in mainstream news, mainstream media, challenging this narrative. So earlier I talked about Justin Trudeau's questionable political future, given how underwater the Liberals and he specifically are in the polls, and whether, you know, it might not be better for the party for him to just step down. And also about the very difficult, you know, tightrope the Liberals are trying to walk on Israel-Palestine. And there's an interesting article or op-ed in iPolitics by journalist and commentator Stephen Marr that kind of ties those things together. So he writes, before Liberals can replace Trudeau, they would have to reckon with Gaza. If the race to succeed Trudeau takes place while Israel is bombing Gaza, would-be leaders would be under intense pressure to appeal to voters who want Canada to push for ceasefire, as they should. A leadership race dominated by an emotional conflict over Middle East policy could leave the Liberals in worse situation than they are now. If the April 16th budget does nothing to improve the polls, Justin Trudeau decides to get out of the way, his successor would face a bruising struggle over the war in Gaza before getting ready to take on Pierre Poilievre. In private meetings and public appearances, Justin Trudeau is resolute. He wants to lead the Liberals in the next election, but some insiders think that polling is so bad that he may be forced to get out of the way to give the party a shot in 2025. Exactly what I've been suggesting. Liberals who hope he will go quietly discussing a scenario where he announces his departure in June, making way for a leadership race over the summer so that a new leader could take over in October, present a fall economic update, and prorogue the House and get ready for an election budget in the spring of 2025. But if the race to succeed Justin Trudeau takes place while Israel is bombing Gaza, would-be leaders would be under intense pressure to appeal to voters who want Canada to push for a ceasefire. A leadership race dominated by an emotional conflict over Middle East policy would leave Canada, the Liberals, in the worst situation they are now. This is the quote from earlier. I find all of that very interesting. That definitely would happen. At the very least, whether it would be like an establishment, like current federal elected Liberal MP or cabinet minister taking that issue as a way to, you know, thrust themselves into the prime minister's office, or something of an outsider, whether in a different jurisdiction of politics or just completely outside of politics, running as like a single issue candidate, definitely you will see people, because, you know, people are so passionate about this. You would see a massive influx of like someone trying of, you know, look, we've seen this in the United States, right, with the non-committal vote against Joe Biden as a protest about his Israel policy. Like, people really, really deeply care about this and are horrified at seeing, you know, our tax dollars possibly going to support a genocide. But so anyway, the article continues. Privately, liberals are worried that the party could be swamped by new members who are only interested in that issue. They're ripe for takeover. Someone's got enough people who are motivated to do it, said one veteran organizer, speaking frankly off the record. During the last leadership race in 2013, the party allowed supporters to vote without buying a party membership. After Trudeau won, the party changed the party constitution to allow members to join and vote without paying. Some longtime liberals are fearful that that would allow the party to be swamped by instant members. To prevent a takeover, the party can redline would-be contenders. I'm not really sure. Does that mean you not allow them to run? Who are using the leadership as a Trojan horse, but the party would have to act carefully since it cannot afford to alienate voters who are angered by the carnage in Gaza. Like, is the assumption here that, okay, people, like, if you want to, if you're joining the Liberal Party, like, they're, like, I don't know that your motivations matter that much, right? If you want to join the Liberals, then you're a Liberal. And because, anyway, so it continues. There are almost 2 million Muslims in Canada, 5 times as many as Jews. I hate this framing, because, like, first of all, it's not just it is not just Muslim. You know, I've seen this so much in the U.S. media and in context of the Joe Biden thing. It's not just Muslims who are horrified by what's happening in Gaza. And it's not just going to be people who are coming in from outside the party. Many liberals, especially younger liberals, are a lot more progressive than you might think. And I do find it a little weird that so many of them do stay with the Liberal Party and not go to somewhere like the NDP or the Greens or whatever, who seem to be more in line with a lot of their actual values and policies. I'm sure there are many, many liberals that are not with Justin Trudeau on this issue. I've seen a lot of them that seem to not even really get what Justin Trudeau's general politics are on Israel-Palestine. Like, you know, Justin Trudeau, like, I remember, you know, years ago was talking about, you know, BDS, the movement to boycott, Israeli products that benefit from the occupation, as a nonviolent way of battling the occupation, much like, you know, what we did with South Africa in, you know, during apartheid. I've run into a number of liberals that, like, when the Ontario NDP leader Mara Stiles Sarah Gemma out of the party there, I remember talking to a liberal who was like, "Oh my God, that's awful. Justin Trudeau would never do anything like that." I'm like, I think he would. I think if the same thing happened or something not as significant, I think he absolutely would. They don't seem to get, like, the liberals are not your friends. The liberal politicians are not your friends on Israel-Palestine. They're not gonna, like, and maybe some of these people will be up for a rude awakening. I wouldn't be surprised if there's a lot of people that get interested into electoral politics through a potential leadership race like this, realize, oh frick, these guys hate us and don't support Palestinian rights at all, and then get disaffected and go to, like, the NDP or something. And also all this talk about, you know, hey, we've opened up our party democracy here, which I think is great, but I think we don't have enough genuine internal party democracy in Canada, especially when political parties are so integral to our democratic system. But they're like, oh, well, but now that the Muslims are voting, maybe let's just rethink this whole free democracy thing. So they mentioned Muslim Canadians are diverse. They come from many different countries, speak different languages, and rarely form a united political coalition. But the war in Gaza is changing that, and many non-Muslims are similarly upset by what is happening in Gaza. Okay, good that they're mentioning that. And also about them talking about that there's five times as many Muslims as Jews. Jewish people are also not going to be a unified political entity. It's not only Muslims that are horrified at what's happening in Gaza and that are pro-Palestinian. It's also not all. First of all, it's mostly not. Obviously, with those numbers, right? It's mostly not Jewish people that are the massive Israel supporters, and also not all Jewish people are Israel supporters at all. We have many groups like Independent Jewish Voices that are pro-Palestinian Jewish groups. What I typically see, like when I go to these rallies and these events, I usually see much more support. You usually see Jewish activists at the forefront of pro-Palestinian activism. So they say if the Liberals can't win back their support, they will be in for an electoral drubbing, losing downtown Toronto seats to the NDP and suburban seats to the Tories. We're effed, says an organizer. Without a doubt, royally effed. Most of the Scarboroughs will go down. Downtown, Davenport, Spadina, Fort York would go down. A couple of the Etobicokes, we would lose a fair chunk. The party's doing no better with Jewish voters, who are similarly unhappy with the Liberal position on the war and are feeling besieged by protests. I guess we struck the right balance, said the organizer, because both sides hate our guts, which is fine in some things, but for electoral purposes, it's not really great to have nobody on your side. Pollster Quito Maggi of Main Street Research says the Liberals are jammed. The Liberal Party has lost largely both communities because they've tried to have it both ways. This sets the stage for a leadership race where Israel supporters and opponents would line up with candidates based only on their Mideast policy, which would cause some kind of cleavage that undercut the leadership of the Green Party leader Naomi Paul in 2021. Like, yeah, I definitely, because I used to be a member of the Green Party. I kind of left after the whole, like, I couldn't justify staying in it after the whole, like, 2021 stuff. For years, it had been a... It almost destroyed the party, right? Because it's obviously such a contentious and emotional issue. And I remember, like, the party grassroots did something as moderate as small as, you know, say we're gonna support BDS, right? We're gonna support the I mentioned it earlier, the boycott Israeli products that benefit from the occupation as the small way of resisting against the occupation and the colonialism. Elizabeth May, I remember, like, saying she was thinking of, like, quitting as leader rather than be leader of the party after they've supported it, even though, like, she sort of supports, like, the tactic but not the movement itself, I guess she was worried about. And when Dimitri Lascaris ran for leader, is very, who is a pro-Palestinian guy. I like his policy on that. I think on so many other things, he is, you know, he's very problematic. And then when Naomi Paul basically got elected and had, she didn't necessarily run on this, but had this, like, pro-Israeli like, fully, like, Zionist position, and even when there was the 2021 attacks on against Gaza, which were horrific, she basically said nothing of it, and had this very non-committal statement, even though the NDP had had a pretty good statement. And there was total revolt over that and many other issues. And that's in a party, so it's so contentious and so emotional with the Green Party, and that's a party that is much more left-wing proportionately than the Liberal Party, right? Like, the Liberal Party is much more of your sort of, like, big tent party where they have, you know, obviously many centrists, you know, your, what's the, blue, you know, blue liberals, people who migrated from the old Progressive Conservative Party. You'll have a lot, I'm sure there will be a lot of people who are, like, you know, more conservative and supportive of the Israeli government. So this, like, yeah, this kind of fight in the liberals when they're already having all these other issues, because I wouldn't be shocked if, even disregarding the Israel issue, if the liberals after the next election were in third place. So this would be like your total nightmare. Okay, so some liberals, this is the craziest part of this article for me. Some liberals think Foreign Affairs Minister Melanie Joly, the Foreign Affairs Minister, who is said to be quietly preparing for a leadership run, might seek to rally opponents of the war behind her. But Behzad Zoubi, a Palestinian-Canadian former NDP staffer, doesn't think Joly would be able to connect with anti-war activists. Yeah, no, like, how is this? Like, I don't know. Like, maybe the liberal, like, organizers suggesting this are just talking completely out of nowhere. But, like, the idea that Melanie Joly, like, if Melanie Joly thinks that she can, you know, that she can get some kind of, like, political advancement, get into the Prime Minister's office by becoming the anti-war candidate, the pro-Palestine candidate. I could see the argument that someone within the government, right, maybe an MP, maybe even a cabinet minister, but who's for, like the housing minister or I was gonna say international development minister, but that kind of wouldn't work either, because that would be Ahmad Hussein, who is kind of the face for Canada cutting off their funding to UNRWA. But like the idea that Melanie Joly, who is literally being the one being sued to stop Canada from exporting military arms to Israel, who is the face, you know, literally Canada's foreign affairs minister, the face of Canada's foreign policy, of Trudeau's foreign policy towards Israel, and his gutless, the gutless way he's going about this war, responding to Israel's war. The idea that she could galvanize anti-war activists, like, is like, maybe she's just like the best brander and gaslighter in the world, but otherwise, like, I cannot see a way that this could ever work. So Zoubi continues, I don't think she can recover from her role. Yeah, frick. Says Zoubi, I think if they were to play that role, they would have to come out and denounce everything that's happened so far, and it makes it really hard for any cabinet minister to do that. Like, yeah, a current cabinet minister is not gonna come out right now and say, oh, like, yeah, if you did that right now and said, okay, this government is complicit in genocide, and we're gonna, and I completely oppose it, and I'm quitting as, or I'm stepping down as minister right now, then okay, maybe you would have some credibility. You need something on that level, but anything short of that, like, no, like, what is she, insane? So Zoubi can't identify prominent liberal poised to harness anti-war sentiment, but she's sure there would be such a candidate because so many Canadians are so upset about the war. And yeah, I definitely agree with that. Any cabinet minister doing that, trying to be that kind of candidate, I can't see it. Maybe some kind of backbencher. I could, if it was going to be, well, like, maybe someone we've just never heard of and we never hear them make any statements, right? There's so many members of parliament. There's many that just, you know, never break into headlines. Or even, like, make speeches. if it was going to be someone who's currently in there and somewhat known, I would say like Nathaniel Erskine Smith, maybe, who's one of the more like sort of like I think he calls himself like a maverick liberal, like does go against Trudeau's policy when he feels like he has to. He is, I think, probably the most outspoken liberal, which, you know, isn't necessarily saying much, but like, he's sort of the most outspoken in, you know, like he supports a ceasefire and, you know, I would hesitate to say like pro-Palestinian, but like Palestine sympathetic, I guess. Otherwise, I feel like it would probably have to be someone coming from a different jurisdiction or someone just completely out of politics entirely, but comes in as like a one-issue anti-war candidate or anti-war and youth candidate, something like that. So the article continues. Liberals nervous about that are thinking that the party will have to impose a fee to prevent massive signups of instant members. This would be a reversal for those who push for an open party with free membership, but it might be necessary both to prevent a takeover and to keep the party from going broke. Like, yeah, so they're completely like abandoning principles because they think they're gonna get a bunch of anti-war liberals. Like pro-Palestinian liberals. And like when you do look at like at least what I often see, not counting the like I stand with Trudeau crowd on Twitter, which is completely manufactured, but like when you do see like liberals like in person online, they tend to be a lot, at least in my experience, they tend to seem a lot more progressive. And this might be like sort of biased towards like I'm exposed to a lot more like younger liberals. But seem a lot more progressive than anyone in the establishment of that party is. So I think like you would be up for a rude awakening, possibly even among the current liberal membership. I think you would probably see a lot of that. How do we? So party official speaking off the record said, how do we create a system that doesn't bankrupt the party? If you do mail-in ballots and you don't charge anything like $10, and if you have to mail out 500,000 ballots, well, you just spend $5 million. Maggie thinks the party will have no choice but to charge liberals to vote. I hate the way we treat party democracy in this country. Like so much, like a lot of the races, like they end up being like almost basically rigged, where the party just picks picks a candidate, we want this person, and they just become the candidate, almost undemocratically. That, you know, effectively happens in a number of cases, and arguably worse, they will be like, oh well, this person, even though they would probably win the nomination, this person is not allowed to be a candidate. And they just can't. I think we should have a much more like grassroots system for party democracy. I don't think we should be treating them like they're just private clubs, because they are, like it or not, they are fundamental to our democracy. You don't have you have more of a grassroots level of direct democracy when you have more when it is truly democratic at that base level of at the party level. So it says the party can't afford to allow itself to be defined by this issue if it wants to win the next election. It's not going to be a defining ballot box question at the next election. I wouldn't be so sure about that, frankly. At the next election, the issue of this conflict, says Maggie. So making leadership about it is going to complicate things because you're not going to end up with a leader that actually has the broadest appeal. Polyev, on the other hand, is facing no internal pressure. Yeah, because the pressure to change his pro-Israel position. Yeah, because the conservatives are heartless, and if anything, they'd be like, oh, shouldn't we be working more actively to let all the Palestinians die? Like, that's their position, and that's after years and years of being conditioned to support these, like, total Islamophobic, you know, Muslims are the savages and all that sort of, you know, clash of civilizations garbage. And he could spend the summer talking about housing and the economy while the liberals tear themselves apart over Gaza. That, I think, is actually a fair point, but I don't... Like, we are seeing the way this is in the U.S. particularly, which is a little bit different because they have a much more active role in the conflict than we do. And, you know, you can make a very convincing argument that Joe Biden, if he changes his position, could basically end the war almost immediately, right? If he really wanted to, like, cut off that aid, was really going to be tough on Netanyahu and tried to genuinely be some kind of honest broker, I think you could end this war relatively quickly. But, like, yeah, I don't think you should underestimate this issue at all and the way people care about it. Okay, so that's the show. Thank you for listening. If you want more of my content, you can go to the YouTube channel. That's CPN with the tag at CPN1205. I have a TikTok where it's at EricJ_0. And, of course, there's a podcast, which is called Special Interest, and you can find that on both Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Hopefully I'll be back next week. Thanks for listening.